All right. I feel like I'm not prepared to do a show today. I'm kind of late getting everything done. And you know what I blame? I was rear-ended on Sunday, but it was like I was on the highway. I don't know why I'm laughing about this. I was on the highway, and the traffic slowed down, and I was going very slow, and a pickup truck came up behind me, hit a silver car. The silver car hit a gold car. The gold car hit my car. And it was like there was so little damage to the car or to me that I just thought maybe I could just drive away and not have to wait for the police report, you know. And I just thought, no, I suppose that's leaving the scene of an accident or something. Anyway, I'm fine unless there's something terribly wrong with me. If I don't do the show correctly, I blame the accident. All right, we have three things we want to talk about today. In the second segment, we're going to talk, you know, I got up this morning and thought, should we talk about Zsa Zsa? And there's sort of obviously an argument for not talking about Zsa Zsa. But then, you know, really, in some ways, she did kind of create the whole notion of being famous for being famous. If she didn't create it, she perfected it. So we are going to talk about Zsa Zsa. And then we're going to talk also in the third segment about, you know, you can almost forget this and all the hubbub, but obviously Ivanka Trump is a convert to Judaism and specifically the modern Orthodox movement. Her husband is a lifelong Orthodox Jew. Therefore, Donald Trump's grandchildren are also Jewish and are going to be attending a shul somewhere in the D.C. area. We're going to talk about that. And I don't know. I'm puzzled by all this. I'm puzzled by the fact that Donald Trump, having these very, very close relations who are Jewish, has not been a little bit more out front in denouncing some of the anti-Semitism, which has characterized his support and his campaign. Anyway, but we're mainly going to talk about how the relevant synagogues in the greater D.C. area are regarding the prospect of having, you know, kind of lightning rod members starting to attend. Anyway, and that's with a writer from Politico. But we're going to begin with a story that I think this is a story that could fly below the radar and maybe almost did. But it's a really interesting story. It's a story of Voice of America, Radio Free Europe, Radio Marti, and a bunch of other affiliated enterprises of the U.S. government. And there has been a change, or there may be a change. It's, I think, still awaiting presidential signature in the way that they're organized and understood and managed. And so here to talk about that is Michael Rosenblum. He's the founder of Rosenblum TV and the founder of TheVJ.com, which is a video training website, founder of Current TV and the past president of New York Times TV. He wrote about this for HuffPost. There's also been some coverage by our own David Folkenflik. And so we want to bring you up to date on this. This is actually kind of an interesting and potentially disturbing story. So, Michael Rosenblum, first of all, welcome to our show and our conversation.
Thanks, Colin. I appreciate you having me on.
So I think, first of all, just we need to lay out the groundwork here. Not everybody is probably familiar with these rather large enterprises of the U.S. government, because if you have lived in the USA all your life, you're probably the one group of people unlikely to be exposed to them. But from a certain point of view, as you point out, this is a sprawling broadcast empire. Give us a sense of how big these overseas broadcasts are in terms of audience size.
The overseas broadcasts for VOA and RFERL are probably about 150 to 200 million, which makes them one of the world's biggest broadcast entities.
And explain what it is that they do. What is their purpose?
Well, this was set up really, you know, in the 1950s, and it was a government-funded broadcast entity that broadcasts originally to communist-controlled countries in the 50s and the 60s. And brought them news and information to societies that were, you know, closed off from Western broadcast. And there was a law in the United States called the Smith Act, because the television networks and the radio networks were quite concerned about competition, which prevented them from broadcasting in the United States. So it's the world's largest broadcaster that no American really knows about.
Right. Although, if you're a person of a certain age, okay, so I'm 62. It was funny because your article said, well, you've probably never heard of Radio Free Europe. Well, if you grew up in America during this, late 50s, early 60s, you heard a lot about Radio Free Europe. It was kind of a big deal at the time. I mean, maybe because of the Cold War and other aspects and just the post-World War II era. But you know, it really was, Radio Free Europe was something that a lot of Americans were familiar with. But as you say, kind of faded into the background. People have other things that they think about and care about. And we wouldn't be having this conversation but for a change that has been pushed through Congress and I think is awaiting presidential signature. Explain what this change is.
Well, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, The Voice of America, and Radio Marti have all been run for most of their history by something called the Broadcast Board of Governors, which was a board comprised of really sort of high-profile broadcast professionals and journalists. And the idea here was to maintain editorial integrity. If you're going to have government-funded broadcasting and it's going to have any traction in the world, you have to make sure that you're not seen as a propaganda arm of the United States government. And that was the point of running it with the Broadcast Board of Governors. Last week, the Republican-controlled House of Representatives put a rider on a bill, a funding bill, a very small, simple little paragraph, that essentially dissolved the Broadcast Board of Governors and put control of Radio Free Europe and VOA and all of them under a presidential appointee, effectively taking away or the potential of taking away their journalistic independence and considering who's coming in the White House, making them a tool of Steve Bannon and Breitbart. It's a very unsettling and frightening event.
So, you know, of course, a lot of these things are open to multiple interpretations. One interpretation of this that I've seen was that the Broadcast Board of Governors wasn't a good way to run such a large, vital, and critical enterprise. You've got a lot of cooks. None of them are really full-time cooks. None of them are really back in the kitchen, you know, where things are happening. So in terms of oversight, in terms of doing a good job, maybe having, you know, a Broadcast Board of Governors of, you know, basically sort of part-time overseers who aren't on the premises isn't the best way to go. Maybe it makes more sense to have one person who's in charge. And I mean, we could discuss about whether or not that person should be a presidential appointee or not. But I don't know. Are you amenable to that argument that this was done at least nominally in the interest of streamlining governance?
No, I don't think so. I mean, by full of disclosure, the BBG and VOA and all of them were clients of mine for 2 years. I took them from shortwave radio into television. I set up VOA TV. And so I got to know them fairly well. I also did TV Marti in Miami. And the people who go to work there are really quite dedicated journalists, and they pride their independence, first because they're good journalists, and second because it's critical for the traction the thing has. Another one of my clients is the BBC, and they've been a client of mine for years. And as you probably know, BBC World Service is highly respected around the world, and that's also run by a governing board. There is no government intervention in the BBC, and there shouldn't be any in VOA. They're going to kill the thing.
Now there is, as I understand it, in David Folkenflik's coverage for NPR, there is a remaining firewall that exists in a different piece of legislation. I think it's the original enabling legislation. So is it necessarily the case that this firewall would be torn down by this new action, or is there some possibility that the independence of the journalists would still be preserved?
Well, the journalists that I've spoken to off the record who are employees of the VOA are extremely concerned about what this means. There's been inherent tension. I was there when the Clinton administration went out and the Bush administration went in, and there was a great deal of pressure put on them by the Bush administration to turn it into more of a propaganda arm. And you know how these are. You get a government appointee and you get lifers who've actually run the place.
Right.
And the lifers inside the VOA and RFERL were adamant about holding on to and the importance of journalistic integrity. And, I mean, the place has been very lucky up until now. For many years, Kevin Close, who ran NPR, you probably know him, also ran RFERL and VOA. So there's been a tradition here of journalism that comes first. And you look at who's going into the White House now, and then you look at Steve Bannon and Breitbart and stuff like that. To me, it's absolutely a terrifying possibility and a very, very real one.
And I mean, I think maybe part of the alarm would be, I assume that this person who would replace the Broadcast Board of Governors and be a single entity presidential appointee overseeing this vast operation would have hiring and firing powers, right?
So that they do have hiring and firing powers, and they have editorial control.
Yeah.
So, I mean, they could, Breitbart could become the American global network with an audience of 200 million people that taxpayers are paying for, and it could happen, you know, in a matter of weeks.
And so, I mean, I guess you're stating your concern. There might be some people listening going, well, aren't you getting a little bit over your skis on this? I mean, it's one thing to say this guy would be a presidential appointee. There's a little bit of a leap across a chasm to say, oh, well, so Breitbart would become, you know, the coin of the realm in terms of talking to people living in other countries.
Well, you know, I mean, I understand NPR, you're trying to be apolitical, but I don't work for you, so I can tell you the truth. This guy Trump is a nightmare, and to put him in the position where he can have any kind of editorial control on worldwide broadcasting of American journalism is, to me, just the worst thing that could possibly happen.
First of all, we're actually a fairly political show for NPR,
good.
So you don't have to worry. I was more like lobbing one up for you to see what you would do with it. But so, yeah, I mean, obviously that is a concern. And as you have noted, what we've seen in general from the sort of the Trump transition and the rhetoric of the Trump campaign is a group of people who have a somewhat different idea towards freedom of the press, even here in the United States.
Absolutely.
You go ahead. Feel free to elaborate on that if you choose.
Well, I don't know if you saw. I did another piece for Huffington Post about 2 weeks ago of a live streaming website where these guys just went around and did all the Trump rallies and web streamed them for free, and they just got White House credentials to go, you know, to press conferences. And in the meantime, Trump, you know, refuses to talk to the Washington Post. So I think there's an undercurrent here in this burgeoning new administration to really denigrate journalism that goes after him and has any quality and replace it with crap that he can control. And to me, what's happened at VOA is just, you know, it's a canary in the coal mine for what this guy is capable of doing.
So, yeah, and obviously he has also said that he would prefer some kind of revision of our libel law.
Yes.
So that it was a little bit easier.
Yes.
To strike back at the
exactly.
press. So I don't know. I don't know if there's another thing to say about this other than the one person who might have some control over it at this point would be President Obama. Folkenflik has reported that at least in the early stages, the Obama administration was okay with this change. Now it's sitting in, I think, a defense bill of some kind. It's one
yes.
minor clause, as you said. He doesn't have the ability to veto a clause. I would assume the probability is this thing's going to be signed.
I'm sure it is going to be signed. And I think in the beginning, when, you know, the Obama administration was looking at it, they probably thought Clinton was going to be the president and this would be actually a fairly good thing. But, you know, this is whole, you know, be careful of what you wish for. And quite now, I think that the danger here is substantial. I spent a great deal of time working with clients overseas. And people, you know, people think that, like you, I'm 62 years old, and I remember those TV commercials where the Russian guy would come and smash the radio, and they would say, if it weren't for Radio Free Europe, nothing would get through. But the world is rapidly returning to a situation of highly repressive governments, particularly in Central Asia and increasingly in, you know, what was formerly Eastern Europe, and certainly in the Middle East, where, you know, state control of broadcasters is becoming the norm as opposed to an anomaly. Even in Russia, you know, Putin has been instrumental in crushing any kind of free press. So the fact is that places like VOA and RFERL begin to take on enormous significance, and they only have any significance if the people who are listening can trust in what the broadcasters and journalists are saying. The thing that makes America different and the great attraction is this notion of a free press and a First Amendment, and I think this guy Trump is just out to crush it.
I hadn't really thought about that, but it's certainly probable that if the Trump administration has any ability to control the content of something like Radio Free Europe, you know,
absolutely.
they're probably going to be saying, hey, you know, Putin's doing a pretty good job, right? I mean, that's kind of their position right now.
Well, you know, and I don't have to tell you fake news and stuff like that. And Breitbart is replete with fake news. I mean, to call it news is almost pornographic. And to give them a tax, I think the budget's about $1.2 billion, a taxpayer-funded budget. There's a global satellite footprint for the whole thing. There's transmission towers all over the world. It's almost pornographic to anybody with any sense of decency.
You know, I guess the just to go back to something that you said a little bit earlier in our conversation, and I think this applies across so many places within the the anticipated Trump administration, this sense of people coming in as cabinet secretaries or other kinds of high-level administrators. And what's there are a group of people who have been there a long time and have an understood way of doing things. And, you know, one of two things can happen. One thing is always that that group of people can successfully push back against interference and say, you know what, this is sort of not the way we do things, and you have to fill that out in triplicate, and we're not even going to tell you where the pencil sharpener is, and just kind of, you know, try to keep things going as they have been by dint of sheer bulk and inertia and time spent doing this. And the other possibility is that if they try that, a whole bunch of them are going to get fired and things are going to change. And there's really no way of knowing which of those outcomes is more likely, right?
Well, it's one thing to go to the, you know, HHS with somebody who has never run an organization. You can imagine the lifers will stand up to him. But it's quite another with a guy like Breitbart, who, you know, Bannon, who's run theoretically a media company. And I'm sure he knows exactly what he's going to do. He's not dumb, and he's not going to be easily manipulated. And the fact is that if it isn't he who's appointed, his minions will simply clean house and put their own people in.
All right. Well, listen, Michael Rosenblum, first of all, I thank you for bringing this to our attention. Your piece is getting circulated a lot on social media. That's where I saw it. I didn't know anything about this. It really is a kind of a news story that save for you and David Folkenflik and a few other people has kind of slid below the radar. So thanks for calling it to our attention. I'm not sure we can do anything about it, but I'm assuming that some of the people listening will want to try.
Great. Thank you, Colin. I appreciate it.
All right. Thanks for being with us. We're going to take a break, and then when we come back, we're going to talk. I shouldn't be laughing because she died, but she was 99. She had a great run. I'm laughing because, you know, this is somebody who, well, I have a lot of thoughts about Zsa Zsa Gabor, and so does our guest coming up, so I'll just wait until then.
The voice of America, your truth and justice ring. Sing Montana in the winter, West Virginia in the spring.
All right, now we come to the point where we really are. There is sort of a continental divide between two generations or two sort of clusters, two nebulae of generations, right? Because for me, for Donald Trump, for other people, Zsa Zsa Gabor, for David Letterman, Zsa Zsa Gabor is this sort of iconic figure. I don't know what the age break point is, but for some of the rest of you, Zsa Zsa Gabor is maybe somebody that a name you don't even recognize or that you barely recognize. So for those of you who are sitting there in the darkness without the light of Zsa Zsa shining upon you, we are about to bring that light. She died yesterday at the age of 99. That's what's called having a good run. She had an especially good run. Our guest Dan Zak writes in the Washington Post, she sang opera, won beauty pageants, waged feuds, suffered strokes, raised horses, wrote, he has that in quotes, books, made exercise videos, lost limbs, well, one, slipped into comas, awoke from comas, sued and was sued, dated Kissinger, danced with Tito. They probably think that's one of the Jacksons, but that's not the Tito he means. Bedded Ataturk, assumed the mantle of princess and duchess, punched a Spanish cop in the 1960s, slapped a Beverly Hills cop in the 1980s. That's called speaking truth to power. Allegedly used Evian to bathe during her 3 days in jail. Bought Elvis's hilltop mansion in Bel Air. Guest starred on The Fresh Prince of Bel Air. And was rushed to the hospital. All caps, more times in the past 20 years than any other resident of Los Angeles County. Although, once you get up in the high 90s, I think you have a right to be rushed to the hospital whenever you want. Before we meet Dan, let's meet Zsa Zsa. Here's a little clip of her. One of her great interlocutors was, is that how you pronounce that word? It was David Letterman. She and Letterman had like a thing. They connected in a certain way. So here she is talking to David Letterman in 1983.
Let me ask you about your, how many times have you been married? Are you married now? Let's just start there.
No, thank God I am not married this time. You see, I was married since I'm 15 years old. As a matter of fact, the press just asked me, say, what did your mother want it for you? I said she wanted me to be happily married. Well, I was 7 times happily married, actually.
So it's been 7?
No, actually 8, but one didn't count. It was only one day.
All right, now let's talk about that. What, if it's going to be one day, what What's the point?
Well, there was no point. I was in Palm Beach. I have a little house there on the polo grounds. And my friends took me into this
Now, that's
Spanish
great. A house
joke.
On the polo grounds. That's
the Palm
great.
Beach
yeah,
polo
that's
country
great.
Club. Well, I play polo, you
Do
see.
Do you really?
Uh-huh.
I wouldn't have guessed that, I guess.
Well, nobody guesses. I'm a horsewoman. Nobody guesses yeah. nothing about me. They think I'm one of those frilly dames, which I really am not. I just look like it.
Yeah.
But I'm really a tomboy. I really am.
A tomboy?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I am.
Now, okay, I'm sorry, you were married.
See, I told you they had chemistry. And one thing I have to recommend to you, it's in Dan's, embedded in Dan's article, but it was the first thing I thought of this morning was David Letterman driving around L.A. with Zsa Zsa going to fast food places. It's up on my Facebook page. If you haven't seen it, see it, but don't see it if you can't afford to be laughing so hard that tears are rolling down your face. All right, that was a long introduction. Now Dan Zak gets to talk. He's the reporter for The Washington Post and the author of Almighty, Courage, Resistance, and Existential Peril in the Nuclear Age, which does not deal explicitly with Zsa Zsa Gabor. However, I think she's a subtext in a lot of places in that book. Dan, welcome to our conversation.
Thank you, Colin.
So one of your main points here is that Zsa Zsa Gabor, if she didn't invent it, she probably perfected the art of being famous for being famous. I'll let you grab the baton and run with it.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, she obviously didn't invent fame, but she put a serious 20th century spin on it. I mean, I think she evolved the notion to fit the times. You know, earlier in her career in Hollywood, after she came over from Hungary, you know, she acted for some pretty big names, for Orson Welles and John Huston and Vincent Minnelli. But I think realized that her best gambit for professional longevity was to be a headline-grabbing socialite, to be her outrageous self, in other words.
I didn't have a chance to look this up on IMDb or anywhere else, but I would guess that her screen credits or her overall acting credits in both television and movies, appearing as herself, probably eclipses the number of times she appeared as any other character.
Yeah, I counted it myself, 14 times she appeared in TV or movies as herself, and they range, of course, from, you know, talk shows like Letterman to A Nightmare on Elm Street 3 to, you know, really maybe her only kind of serious featured role, which is in John Huston's Moulin Rouge, although she did have a very bit part in Orson Welles' Touch of Evil.
Ooh, I'd forgotten that. All right. So, which then that is like a classic movie, too.
Yeah.
So then the question becomes sort of tracing her lineage forward in time. I mean, I think one of the things that we can say is because she is a product of a more decorous era, to be now or to be at any time in the last, let's say, 15 years, to be what Zsa Zsa once was, you actually have to have a sex tape as opposed to an implied range of serial amorous encounters.
Yeah, I mean, she was able to kind of stay, I don't know if relevant is the right word, but stay visible just through kind of the well-timed one-liner. I mean, these kind of tweetable things she would say over the years, you know, the one that people are talking about now that seems to have risen to the top of her quotable quotes is, you know, "I'm a marvelous housekeeper. Every time I leave a man, I keep his house." There's something quaint about a one-liner like that, at least in this day and age. I mean, obviously the contemporary names invoked since news of her death have been Paris Hilton and Kim Kardashian, who have done in the 21st century what Zsa Zsa did in the 20th, and that's use the media of the day to achieve this kind of baffling ubiquity. And it used to be tabloid headlines and wry one-liners exclusively, and now, yeah, that may include a sex tape.
I think there's also, I don't know, so I'm so incredibly old. Like, I remember the Jack Parr show. And so on Jack Parr, he would have people on not because they had really accomplished anything recently, but gratifyingly, not because they were there to play a clip of some new movie or TV show and then ruthlessly promote it, but because they were sort of bon vivants and they were kind of interesting people to talk to. There was this singer named Genevieve, except that I don't think anybody owned any records by Genevieve. She was just this good talker, and Oscar Levant would come on because he was a good talker, not because he had anything out. And Zsa Zsa, although, I mean, no one was going to going to mistake her for Oscar Wilde or even Sarah Silverman. But there was sort of a sense that maybe in a way that Anna Nicole Smith and Paris Hilton and Kim Kardashian failed to be, you could plop her down on a couch on a TV show and she would sort of hold her own in an entertainingly bubbly way.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. She was self-aware enough to realize that she was capable of both making jokes and being the joke. And I think that's why she got along with Letterman. I think they both, she kind of, you know, Letterman appreciated absurdity, and she knew that she was absurd. So it was a great friendship, I think. You know, there was some kind of truth that she let out when she was brought onto a show like Letterman's. I mean, the thing that I think about that's not often quoted is she said to him at one point, "There is no bigger aphrodisiac than power." Mm-hmm. And there she is, kind of articulating in a very sophisticated way exactly why she was married as many times as she was, why she flaunted her wealth or her appearance of wealth. So I think you're exactly right. There was substance behind kind of this conspicuous glamour.
And she also was, as you have suggested, willing to put up with kind of a low joke here and there. This fast food Letterman thing is hilarious. And really, I was weeping with laughter. I'd seen it before, but I watched it again today. But, you know, there's a moment, having visited about 8 fast food places where they pull up outside an In-N-Out burger, and Letterman just says, "You can make up your own jokes." And that's sort of a low blow. But, I mean, she gets what her reputation is. She is someone who is, you know, made jokes about herself, her ability to exploit her own sex appeal for all kinds of benefits, including marital ones.
Yeah, I think that self-awareness is why her name, to some degree at least, is still known now, a day after her death at 99, is because if she wasn't willing to play along, if she didn't get herself, I don't think she would have, her name, her identity would have survived past, you know, the 60s.
Well, also, she did have, as you point out in your piece, this aura of indomitability right up to the end. I mean, this is a woman who, by the time she's 99 years old and facing death, she's faced death about 25 other times. She's lost a leg to an infection. It wasn't going to be easy to take her out.
Right, exactly. And I think at some point, you know, either she or her publicity team or them in concert with each other realized that even in old age, you could get headlines by saying that, you know, Zsa Zsa's near death again. I mean, we saw that headline various times over the past 10 to 15 years. And it just so happened that this time, most recently this February, and it just happened that this time, this headline was actually followed by her passing.
So here's my psychosexual third rail theory of the day. So I've been thinking a lot generally for the last 9 months or 12 months or so about Donald Trump's days of growing up. What was it like growing up to be Donald Trump? And here the math is pretty easy to do. Trump is 70. Zsa Zsa was 99. So that means that as Donald Trump was a boy watching television and kind of trying to decide what a beautiful woman was, and as he even moved from prepubescence into puberty, you know, Zsa Zsa was probably at the peak of her lusciousness and her louche sex appeal, and she would have been on television a lot. You know, she would have been, and you know that Trump is the kind of guy who watched a lot of talk shows and, you know, had a lot of his understanding of popular culture, but maybe also of life too. A lot of it was formed and imprinted like a baby duck by what he probably saw on television as a kid. So, you know, so my third rail psychosexual theory of the day is, he's married 2 Eastern European women, you know?
Yeah.
Go ahead. I don't know.
I think that's an interesting theory that sounds like it could be right to me. But even beyond kind of the psychosexual element of that, I think that you could say that she did what he has done since in terms of dealing with the media. She made I write in the piece, she made classiness tacky and tackiness classy in a way that the president-elect has done for 30 years, this kind of conspicuous wealth, gold and marble and diamonds. A few years ago, the gossip columnist Cindy Adams told Vanity Fair that Zsa Zsa and her sisters quote, lived with no reality and lied about everything. So decades before reality TV, Twitter, Instagram, the Gabor sisters were their own products, their own brands. And then in the 80s, you have Donald Trump talking about truthful hyperbole. That's a term that he had in one of his books, and how you talk something up so that it glitters in the public's mind. And that's what he's done during his career to his projects and to himself. But Zsa Zsa did it long before him.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, she obviously was an influence on him and the kind of language and imagery that he's used to create his own, quote, mystique, unquote. But I do believe also that when he met Ivana in particular, there was some little part of his brain, maybe not the conscious part of his brain, saying, I can actually have Zsa Zsa. I can have, you know, this incredible prize that was paraded in front of me on television for most of my early puberty. I can have the ultimate prize. I happen to be one of the people who believes that if he'd stayed with Ivana, if that marriage had held together, we wouldn't be so worried about descending into a fascist dystopia right now, that she was, in fact, a redeeming force in his life. But I think she also was, you know, a force planted there by Zsa Zsa. So,
well, I'll make a deal with you.
Okay.
If the president
I want to hear this deal.
Ever holds a press conference, yeah, and I'm there, I will ask him if Zsa Zsa factored into his adolescent yearnings. How about that?
Dan, you just want to lose your White House press credentials, don't you? They're just weighing down your wallet right now. You're trying to get rid of them. It would be interesting to see if Trump does say anything, because I think you're absolutely right. You make this point in the article. They are products of the same kind of celebrity machinery, and so many of the tripwires that she kicked are the tripwires that he kicks. It'll be interesting to see if he does say any. I mean, does she even merit a tweet? I mean, everything merits a tweet from this guy. Can Zsa Zsa get a tweet?
You know, I don't know. I mean, obviously she was a West Coast figure, and he's a very much a New York figure. I mean, they did intersect in the context of the Miss America pageant in the 80s.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she attended the 1988 Miss America pageant, was photographed with both Donald and Ivana Trump. So they definitely at times moved in the same circles. But, you know, I'm not sure if they were friendly or anything like that. But they did occasionally bump into each other at events that were kind of as superficial as a beauty pageant.
So, Dan, you and I are doing our best to send people stampeding towards this Letterman fast food video. But one of the people that we see also apparently kind of in on the joke in this Letterman fast food video is her husband, Frederick, who I believe was her husband right up to the time of her death. And therefore, one of the longer lasting Zsa Zsa Gabor husbands of all time. What do we know? He's a prince, right? Is he a German prince of some kind?
Well, he's a prince in that he was able to buy the title. So it's not like he inherited, any kind of title. His age is as vague as Zsa Zsa's was. You know, Zsa Zsa at one point was saying that she was born in 1930 and not 1916. And if you believe she was born in 1930, then she was seven when she got married the first time. So, they kind of made this kind of vague semi-power couple. I mean, even though he was maybe 20 or 25 years younger, he's still in his 70s now. I have to admit, I don't know a lot about him other than they've been together since the 80s, he's not a prince in the sense that he comes from a long line of royalty. He's a prince in the Zsa Zsa sense, that he was able to pay for a certain degree of notoriety.
A prince in the Zsa Zsa sense. I think that's perfect. There's his epitaph. But Dan Zak, so great to talk to you, reporter for The Washington Post. Everybody go out and read Dan's terrific article about this. He's also the author of Almighty, Courage, Resistance, and Existential Peril in the Nuclear Age, which when was that published?
It was published in July.
So all right, so you're right on schedule.
Yeah,
here.
I have a varied job writing about nuclear weapons and Zsa Zsa Gabor, but I wouldn't have it any other way.
Absolutely. And not only that, but I mean, sales have got to take an uptick here. There's more existential peril now than there was like in June.
Well, this presidential campaign and the president-elect have certainly kept nuclear weapons more in the forefront of the American consciousness than they usually are. So we've got that going for us.
All right. Well, we're going to grab a break here. Dan, so great to talk to you, and we'll come back. We will not be talking about Zsa Zsa Gabor anymore, but we will be talking about another offshoot of the vast Trump family.
There is a big cut on my head. Today's show was produced by Betsy Kaplan and me, Kyone Wolf. The part of Bill Curry was played by Ivana Trump. Hear all of our shows at WNPR.org/Colin or on Stitcher, iTunes, or TuneIn. On tomorrow's show, the future of music in the digital age. And now, back to Colin.
Yeah, let me tell you a little bit about tomorrow's show. You might have even noticed this guy because we use his music a lot. You know, I mean, a lot of times Wolfie, who plans out the music for our show, you know, I mean, we're doing a show and maybe we need somebody. Is there a song about David Letterman? Did anybody write a song about David Letterman? Did anybody ever write a song about this odd topic that we're talking about? And a lot of times somebody has, and it's almost always the same guy. His name is Matt Farley. He writes or performs under other nom de guerre, and he writes songs about just about everything. I mean, when we think there couldn't possibly be a song about this, apparently he wrote one called Poop, 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 Poop that we did. But, I mean, I think, you know, I don't know that we got one about Wilhelm Reich out of him. But, I mean, like a lot of times when we're doing a show about a person, it turns out he's written a song about that person. And you'll recognize him tomorrow because the songs often don't necessarily represent, you know, say Richard Rodgers' standards for songwriting craft. You know, it's often kind of a plonk, plonk, plonk piano thing, and as he does his own vocals. And he, you know, he wrote a song called I Hate Helping People Move, I'm being told. And he's not a great vocalist or anything, nor does he appear to be putting a lot of work into the vocals. And there's a reason for all of this. He's crazy like a fox. And we're going to explain to you tomorrow why that is, why he's crazy like a fox. It has something to do, I mean, maybe you're aware of the fact that in the digital age, artists sometimes are having trouble getting paid for their musical compositions the way they got paid in the past. It's been hard to police a lot of this stuff. And, you know, do you get paid in a reasonable way by something like Pandora and stuff like that? But there are people, and he's one of them, who figured out how to make this work for him rather than against him. And we're going to explain all of that to you tomorrow. I don't know what else to say about that except stay tuned. All right, so we're getting ready here for our final segment here. And we're going to be talking, we just talked quite a bit about Ivana Trump. Now we're going to talk about Ivanka Trump. And joining us is Annie Carney, White House reporter for Politico. She wrote in this morning's Politico about Ivanka Trump and Jared Kushner, who will be searching for a place to pray in Washington. They're Jewish. They are, in fact, part of a Jewish movement called Modern Orthodoxy. And we're going to tell you more about that. But first of all, let's welcome Annie to this conversation. Hi.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So this is, you know, in some ways, you know, there's so much tumult and hubbub around the Trump administration that there are all these kind of fascinating storylines that can easily get lost. And this is one that I think people don't pay that much attention to. But we really are. It's kind of a watershed moment. We knew that no matter who got elected, we were going to have a Jewish son-in-law. But the Clinton-Mesvinskys are apparently very secular. The Trump-Kushners are not. They are the opposite. They take their religion very seriously. So tell us more about this. They obviously are going to need a shul, a synagogue. Do they know which one they're going to get?
So Jared Kushner is comes from a very Orthodox family. He observes the Sabbath. He walks to synagogue. Observes the high holidays. If you're a modern Orthodox Jew, you need to live within walking distance of a synagogue where you go to pray on Saturdays. And this is like a prime concern as they do their real estate hunt in New York. Ivanka Trump is also like a very traditional practicing Jew now. She converted in order for them to get married. And they're looking, so it is like a big question in the Jewish community in Washington of where will they pray? And in Washington, the main modern Orthodox synagogue is in Georgetown. It's called Kesher Israel. It's where Joe Lieberman went when he was the vice presidential nominee. It's where Leon Wieseltier goes, like a famous liberal writer. It's where all kind of the power brokers who are Jews pray. And it has the whole community there wondering, like, what's it going to be, even for this place that's used to having really impressive, powerful people there, like, this is very unusual to have Ivanka and Jared sitting there with people who have been publicly critical of Trump, calling him unfit for office for the past 18 months, are now going to sit and pray next to his children.
Right. Well, the first thing, yeah, the first thing that they're that your article is terrific, by the way. And one of the things that it makes clear is, I mean, there are a couple of little areas of concern. One of them is, you know, wherever you go to worship, no matter what kind of worshiper you are or what, you know, what religion you're enrolled in, you know, it is. And I think particularly the way the Sabbath is understood for Orthodox Jews, it's a time of quiet and reflection and peace. It is specifically the time when you think about other things other than your worldly concerns. So the one thing that you don't want is, you know, I don't know, you don't want a CNN truck anywhere in the vicinity, right?
Exactly. Yeah, you don't want, I mean, I think that's a lot of people's concerns, is that I think people that I talk to who are part of that community are torn. Like, on the one hand, it's kind of exciting to have two of the most powerful people in the world part of your small intimate community. On the other, they don't want to be the center of this political hurricane. And I'm sure CNN trucks will sit there if Ivanka and Jared are walking in and out. I mean, this is going to be a spectacle. So not a lot of people want this kind of holy, literally holy ritual disrupted like that. But then again, this is why Kesher Israel is kind of, people I talk to there think it is the best place for them. Like, they've addressed these issues before. This is one of the funniest things that I found out, was that when Joe Lieberman got Secret Service, when he became the vice presidential nominee in 2000, the synagogue had to figure out the biblical answer of, can practicing Jews walk through the magnetic detectors on Shabbat? Or is that against the rules of doing no work on the Sabbath? And the rabbi ruled that, you know, you can't walk through the metal detector, but if the Secret Service uses a wand on you, then the Secret Service person is doing the work and you're not doing the work. So they've kind of answered some of these difficult questions of modern life while you're being a traditional Jew. And so they, you know, they have dealt with high profile people before, but not really at this level.
Right. And I think the fact that, so then we get to the question of ideology. Now, I think the fact, being from Joe Lieberman's home state, I think the fact that Joe Lieberman, notwithstanding his presence on the Democratic ticket in 2000, the fact that Joe Lieberman went there would not be, or that Hadassah Lieberman might be found praying in the upper level there, would not be troublesome, would not be a problem for Ivanka and Jared. In a lot of ways, they're all birds of a feather. They're people who find it very easy to communicate, right? I mean, the other thing that Ivanka and Jared represent are the ability, the group of people within the Trump clan who are the most comfortable in dialogue with Democrats, with people of liberal persuasions. I mean, you know, Chelsea and Ivanka were celebratedly good friends, right?
Yeah, I mean, they're very used to being among social groups where they are aware that most people don't like Donald Trump, that most people don't agree with them, and sort of keeping themselves both at the same time part of his inner circle, but also seemingly removed from his most extreme policies, and sort of still being accepted in those circles and feeling comfortable in those circles. So they've done a pretty incredible job of sort of walking this fine line between being associated and being disassociated at the same time.
And as you point out, there are going to be people there like Leon Wieseltier, who told Americans in a Washington Post op-ed piece to stay angry about Trump. But the good thing, I don't know, I'm going to have you tell us a little bit more about the modern Orthodox movement in just a second here. But, you know, the good thing about going to an Orthodox synagogue as opposed to a Quaker meeting house or even the kind of church that I go to is, my sense is, you know, there isn't really a lot of occasion for people to sit around talking about what was in the Washington Post or airing their political beliefs or stuff like that. I mean, you're there to worship and to be part of your own religion. So, I mean, I'm guessing Leon and Jared aren't going to get into fisticuffs.
No, I don't think so. And I talked, Norm Eisen is quoted in my story. He's the former Obama ethics czar, and he has been publicly writing about Trump on TV, talking about Trump, talking about how he could be violating the Constitution by not releasing his tax returns, by not divesting from his businesses. He's been, you know, talking about how he might be unfit for office. And he, in my story, says, you know, he liked politics, like cell phones, like money, are the things you leave on the side on Shabbat. and he's willing to do that, that if Jared and Ivanka came and Jared was sitting next to him in synagogue, that he respects him as a fellow faithful person, and it could all be left at the door. It won't be a problem for him, he says. But it doesn't stop people from just finding the whole situation just totally bizarre.
Yeah, and thrilling and possibly even tickling in some ways.
Yeah.
So the modern Orthodox movement is, I did a little reading about it after I read your article today. It's exactly what it sounds like. It's Orthodox Judaism, and it doesn't take one exclusive shape. There are a couple of different ways that it's understood and interpreted, but it is Orthodox Judaism, which makes some accommodation for the fact that we're living in 2016.
Yes. And then, I mean, Jared is pretty devout, but, you know, there's been times during this transition where he's had to go to Trump Tower to work. And Joe Lieberman used to have to, like, I think there are a lot of scenes of him walking to the Senate after synagogue on a Saturday. So they kind of, the trick is making it work with a busy modern lifestyle. So they would walk. They wouldn't take a car. They try and stay off their phones that day. But if there's an emergency that requires their work, they kind of figure out how to observe the rules and make it work at the same time.
I think it's true. I may have forgotten this detail, but I think it's true that Joe Lieberman, in order to be able to walk to the Capitol, lived maybe at certain times only, I don't know, with Al Gore's parents because they live close
really?
Enough so you can walk. You might have to double check that one. I might be wrong about this.
I will. But yeah, I mean, that it will affect where they live. Because yeah. They will probably have to live within walking distance. I mean, first of all, we need to figure out what their jobs are. But if Jared Kushner is going to take a job inside the White House as a senior advisor, I would imagine they have to live within walking distance of the West Wing if that's where the work is going to be happening. And he's going to be maybe called in a crisis on a Saturday. That's something that they would take into account in their real estate search.
I'm going to bring up one more thing that's of interest to me. It's not part of your article, and you don't have to say anything about it if you don't want to. But, you know, your article really got me thinking about this, and I've thought about it before. But, you know, we always assume that when somebody gets elected and it's a kind of watershed moment, that their lived reality is going to affect their policy in a very significant way. So that, you know, there might be white politicians who, quote, unquote, get black issues, but not the way an African-American president would. So it's really interesting uh-huh. when somebody – and, you know, I think we all thought, well, there are male politicians who get women's issues, but not the way a woman president would. You know, if you had a woman uh-huh. president, she'd be just so in touch with these things. And so Donald Trump is not a Jewish president, but his number one daughter, the woman who placed his name in nomination and the mother of his grandchildren and his son-in-law are not just Jewish, but they're Orthodox and they're observant. And, you know, this really is kind of a watershed moment for a first family. And at the same time, you know, he hasn't really completely quelled or distanced himself from some of the attitudes expressed by Breitbart when Steve Bannon was there. Instead, he's brought Bannon into the White House, you know, and uh-huh. there certainly were, you know, eruptions of anti-Semitism all through this campaign. And you kind of, uh-huh. I'm kind of waiting for this guy to say, hey, those are my grandchildren you're talking about. I just don't do that, you know, and you're not
yeah.
going to do it either. Go ahead.
I mean, we'll see. So, I mean, yeah, Jared Kushner is the grandson of Holocaust survivors. I think that his being so close there, I feel comfortable saying it makes Jews more comfortable that he's there, that he is on the inner circle. But then again, like Ivanka and Jared have been talked about as these moderating influences on Trump for 18 months. But the question is, where do we see it actually influencing him at all so far? I mean, we haven't actually seen him do anything. Things will change when he's president. But despite Ivanka talking about women's issues and claiming that she cares about climate change, we don't see Trump moderating his rhetoric he appointed a climate denier to head the EPA. So we don't yet see, despite Ivanka and Jared maybe being moderate people close to him, I don't think we've seen yet that they've had a moderating effect.
Yeah.
We'll see if that happens later. But I do think that that Jews must feel some level of relief.
I'm not sure they do. I don't think that they have any reason to yet, you know, because none of that stuff has really been put to bed. Annie Carney, unfortunately, we're out of time. Annie Carney, White House reporter for Politico. She wrote this morning about Ivanka Trump and Jared Kushner's search for a place to pray in Washington. We will be back tomorrow with a show about unusual music.